This episode, we continue reading the second half of the 2010 opinion of the court in Citizens United v. Federal Election Commission. Picking up where we ended last episode, we begin with part three of the opinion. Part three. The First Amendment provides that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. Laws enacted to control or suppress speech may operate at different points in the speech process. The following are just a few examples of restrictions that have been attempted at different stages of the speech process. All laws found to be invalid. Restrictions requiring a permit at the outset. Imposing a burden by impounding proceeds on receipts or royalties. Seeking to exact a cost after the speech occurs. And subjecting the speaker to criminal penalties. The law before us is an outright ban, backed by criminal sanctions. Section 441B makes it a felony for all corporations, including nonprofit advocacy corporations, either to expressly advocate the election or defeat of candidates, or to broadcast electioneering communications within 30 days of a primary election and 60 days of a general election. Thus, the following acts would all be felonies under Section 441B. The Sierra Club runs an ad within the crucial phase of 60 days before the general election that exhorts the public to disapprove of a congressman who favors logging in national forests. The National Rifle Association publishes a book urging the public to vote for the challenger because the incumbent U.S. senator supports a handgun ban. And the American Civil Liberties Union creates a website telling the public to vote for a presidential candidate in the light of that candidate's defense of free speech. These prohibitions are classic examples of censorship. Section 441B is a ban on corporate speech, notwithstanding the fact that a PAC created by a corporation can still speak. A PAC is a separate association from the corporation. So the PAC exemption from Section 441B's expenditure ban does not allow corporations to speak. Even if a PAC could somehow allow a corporation to speak, and it does not, the option to form PACs does not alleviate the First Amendment problems with Section 441B. PACs are burdensome alternatives. They are expensive to administer and subject to extensive regulations. For example, every PAC must appoint a treasurer, forward donations to the treasurer promptly, keep detailed records of the identities of the persons making donations, preserve receipts for 3 years, and file an organization statement and report changes to this information within 10 days. And that is just the beginning. PACs must file detailed monthly reports with the FEC, which are due at different times depending on the type of election that is about to occur. These reports must contain information regarding the amount of cash on hand, the total amount of receipts, detailed by 10 different categories, the identification of each political committee and candidate's authorized or affiliated committee making contributions, and any persons making loans, providing rebates, refunds, dividends, or interest, or any other offset to operating expenditures in an aggregate amount of over $200. The total amount of all disbursements, detailed by 12 different categories, the names of all authorized or affiliated committees to whom expenditures aggregating over $200 have been made, persons to whom loan repayments or refunds have been made, the total sum of all contributions, operating expenses, outstanding debts and obligations, and the settlement terms of the retirement of any debt or obligation. PACs have to comply with these regulations just to speak. This might explain why fewer than 2,000 of the millions of corporations in this country have PACs. PACs, furthermore, must exist before they can speak. Given the onerous restrictions, a corporation may not be able to establish a PAC in time to make its views known regarding candidates and issues in a current campaign. Section 441B's prohibition on corporate independent expenditures is thus a ban on speech. As a restriction on the amount of money a person or group can spend on political communication during a campaign, that statute necessarily reduces the quantity of expression by restricting the number of issues discussed, the depth of their exploration, and the size of the audience reached. Were the court to uphold these restrictions, the government could repress speech by silencing certain voices at any of the various points in the speech process. Part 3. The First Amendment provides that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. Laws enacted to control or suppress speech may operate at different points in the speech process. The following are just a few examples of restrictions that have been attempted at different stages of the speech process. All laws found to be invalid. PACs have to comply with these regulations just to speak. This might explain why fewer than 2,000 of the millions of corporations in this country have PACs. PACs, furthermore, must exist before they can speak. Given the onerous restrictions, a corporation may not be able to establish a PAC in time to make its views known regarding candidates and issues in a current campaign. Section 441B's prohibition on corporate independent expenditures is thus a ban on speech. As a restriction on the amount of money a person or group can spend on political communication during a campaign, that statute necessarily reduces the quantity of expression by restricting the number of issues discussed, the depth of their exploration, and the size of the audience reached. Were the court to uphold these restrictions, the government could repress speech by silencing certain voices at any of the various points in the speech process. If Section 441B applied to individuals, no one would believe that it is merely a time, place, or manner restriction on speech. Its purpose and effect are to silence entities whose voices the government deems to be suspect. Speech is an essential mechanism of democracy, For it is the means to hold officials accountable to the people. The right of citizens to inquire, to hear, to speak, and to use information to reach consensus is a precondition to enlightened self-government and a necessary means to protect it. The First Amendment has its fullest and most urgent application to speech uttered during a campaign for political office. For these reasons, political speech must prevail against laws that would suppress it, whether by design or inadvertence. Laws that burden political speech are subject to strict scrutiny, which requires the government to prove that the restriction furthers a compelling interest and is narrowly tailored to achieve that interest. While it might be maintained that political speech simply cannot be banned or restricted as a categorical matter, the quoted language from WRTL provides a sufficient framework for protecting the relevant First Amendment interests in this case. We shall employ it here. Premised on mistrust of governmental power, the First Amendment stands against attempts to disfavor certain subjects or viewpoints. Prohibited, too, are restrictions distinguishing among different speakers, allowing speech by some but not others. As instruments to censor, these categories are interrelated. Speech restrictions based on the identity of the speaker are all too often simply a means to control content. Quite apart from the purpose or effect of regulating content, moreover, the government may commit a constitutional wrong when by law it identifies certain preferred speakers. By taking the right to speak from some and giving it to others, the government deprives the disadvantaged person or class of the right to use speech to strive to establish worth, standing, and respect for the speaker's voice. The government may not by these means deprive the public of the right and privilege to determine for itself what speech and speakers are worthy of consideration. The First Amendment protects speech and speaker and the ideas that flow from each. Restrictions requiring a permit at the outset. Imposing a burden by impounding proceeds on receipts or royalties. Seeking to exact a cost after the speech occurs. And subjecting the speaker to criminal penalties. The court has upheld a narrow class of speech restrictions that operate to the disadvantage of certain persons. But these rulings were based on an interest in allowing governmental entities to perform their functions. The corporate independent expenditures at issue in this case, however, would not interfere with governmental functions, so these cases are inapposite. These precedents stand only for the proposition that there are certain governmental functions that cannot operate without some restrictions on particular kinds of speech. By contrast, it is inherent in the nature of the political process that voters must be free to obtain information from diverse sources in order to determine how to cast their votes. At least before Austin, the court had not allowed the exclusion of a class of speakers from the general public dialogue. We find no basis for the proposition that, in the context of political speech, the government may impose restrictions on certain disfavored speakers. Both history and logic lead us to this conclusion. Section A, 1. The court has recognized that First Amendment protection extends to corporations. This protection has been extended by explicit holdings to the context of political speech. Under the rationale of these precedents, political speech does not lose First Amendment protection simply because its source is a corporation. The court has thus rejected the argument that political speech of corporations or other associations should be treated differently under the First Amendment simply because such associations are not natural persons. At least since the latter part of the 19th century, the laws of some states and of the United States imposed a ban on corporate direct contributions to candidates. Yet not until 1947 did Congress first prohibit independent expenditures by corporations and labor unions in Section 304 of the Labor Management Relations Act of 1947. In passing this act, Congress overrode the veto of President Truman, who warned that the expenditure ban was a dangerous intrusion on free speech. For almost three decades thereafter, the court did not reach the question whether restrictions on corporate and union expenditures are constitutional. The question was in the background of United States v. CIO, 1948. There, a labor union endorsed a congressional candidate in its weekly periodical. The court stated that the gravest doubt would arise in our minds as to the federal expenditure prohibition's constitutionality if it were construed to suppress that writing. The law before us is an outright ban, backed by criminal sanctions. Section 441B makes it a felony for all corporations, including nonprofit advocacy corporations, either to expressly advocate the election or defeat of candidates, or to broadcast electioneering communications within 30 days of a primary election and 60 days of a general election. The court engaged in statutory interpretation and found the statute did not cover the publication. Four justices, however, said they would reach the constitutional question and invalidate the Labor Management Relations Act's expenditure ban. The concurrence explained that any undue influence generated by a speaker's large expenditures was outweighed by the loss for democratic processes resulting from the restrictions upon free and full public discussion. In United States v. Automobile Workers, 1957, the court again encountered the independent expenditure ban, which had been recodified at 18 U.S.C. Section 610. After holding only that a union television broadcast that endorsed candidates was covered by the statute, the court refused to anticipate constitutional questions and remanded for the trial to proceed. Three justices dissented, arguing that the court should have reached the constitutional question and that the ban on independent expenditures was unconstitutional. Under our Constitution, it is we the people who are sovereign. The people have the final say. The legislators are their spokesmen. The people determine through their votes the destiny of the nation. It is therefore important, vitally important, that all channels of communications be open to them during every election, that no point of view be restrained or barred, and that the people have access to the views of every group in the community. The dissent concluded that deeming a particular group too powerful was not a justification for withholding First Amendment rights from any group, labor or corporate. The court did not get another opportunity to consider the constitutional question in that case, for after a remand, a jury found the defendants not guilty. Later, in Pipe Fitters v. United States, 1972, the court reversed a conviction for expenditure of union funds for political speech, again without reaching the constitutional question. The court would not resolve that question for another 4 years. Section A2. In Buckley, the court addressed various challenges to the Federal Election Campaign Act of 1971, FECA, as amended in 1974. These amendments created 18 U.S.C. Section 608E, an independent expenditure ban separate from Section 610 that applied to individuals as well as corporations and labor unions. Before addressing the constitutionality of Section 608E's independent expenditure ban, Buckley first upheld Section 608B, FECA's limits on direct contributions to candidates. The Buckley Court recognized a sufficiently important governmental interest in the prevention of corruption and the appearance of corruption. This followed from the court's concern that large contributions could be given to secure a political quid pro quo. Thus, the following acts would all be felonies under Section 441B. The Sierra Club runs an ad within the crucial phase of 60 days before the general election that exhorts the public to disapprove of a congressman who favors logging in national forests. The National Rifle Association publishes a book urging the public to vote for the challenger because the incumbent U.S. senator supports a handgun ban. And the American Civil Liberties Union creates a website telling the public to vote for a presidential candidate in the light of that candidate's defense of free speech. These prohibitions are classic examples of censorship. The Buckley Court explained that the potential for quid pro quo corruption distinguished direct contributions to candidates from independent expenditures. The court emphasized that the independent expenditure ceiling fails to serve any substantial governmental interest in stemming the reality or appearance of corruption in the electoral process. Because the absence of pre-arrangement and coordination alleviates the danger that expenditures will be given as a quid pro quo for improper commitments from the candidate. Buckley invalidated Section 608E's restrictions on independent expenditures, with only one justice dissenting. Buckley did not consider Section 610's separate ban on corporate and union independent expenditures, the prohibition that had also been in the background in CIO, automobile workers, and pipe fitters. Had Section 610 been challenged in the wake of Buckley, however, it could not have been squared with the reasoning and analysis of that precedent. The expenditure ban invalidated in Buckley, Section 608E, applied to corporations and unions. And some of the prevailing plaintiffs in Buckley were corporations. The Buckley Court did not invoke the First Amendment's overbreadth doctrine to suggest that Section 608E's expenditure ban would have been constitutional if it had applied only to corporations and not individuals. Buckley cited with approval the automobile workers' dissent, which argued that Section 610 was unconstitutional. Notwithstanding this precedent, Congress recodified Section 610's corporate and union expenditure ban at 2 U.S.C. Section 441B 4 months after Buckley was decided. Section 441B is the independent expenditure restriction challenged here. Less than 2 years after Buckley, Bilotti reaffirmed the First Amendment principle that the government cannot restrict political speech based on the speaker's corporate identity. Bilotti could not have been clearer when it struck down a state law prohibition on corporate independent expenditures related to referenda issues. We thus find no support in the First Amendment or in the decisions of this court for the proposition that speech that otherwise would be within the protection of the First Amendment loses that protection simply because its source is a corporation that cannot prove, to the satisfaction of a court, a material effect on its business or property. That proposition amounts to an impermissible legislative prohibition of speech based on the identity of the interests that spokesman may represent in public debate over controversial issues, and a requirement that the speaker have a sufficiently great interest in the subject to justify communication. Section 441B is a ban on corporate speech, notwithstanding the fact that a PAC created by a corporation can still speak. A PAC is a separate association from the corporation. So the PAC exemption from Section 441B's expenditure ban does not allow corporations to speak. Even if a PAC could somehow allow a corporation to speak, and it does not, the option to form PACs does not alleviate the First Amendment problems with Section 441B. In the realm of protected speech, the legislature is constitutionally disqualified from dictating the subjects about which persons may speak and the speakers who may address a public issue. It is important to note that the reasoning and holding of Bilotti did not rest on the existence of a viewpoint discriminatory statute. It rested on the principle that the government lacks the power to ban corporations from speaking. Bilotti did not address the constitutionality of the state's ban on corporate independent expenditures to support candidates. In our view, however, that restriction would have been unconstitutional under Bilotti's central principle that the First Amendment does not allow political speech restrictions based on a speaker's corporate identity. Section A3. Thus the law stood until Austin. Austin upheld a direct restriction on the independent expenditure of funds for political speech for the first time in this court's history. There, the Michigan Chamber of Commerce sought to use general treasury funds to run a newspaper ad supporting a specific candidate. Michigan law, however, prohibited corporate independent expenditures that supported or opposed any candidate for state office. A violation of the law was punishable as a felony. The court sustained the speech prohibition. To bypass Buckley and Bilotti, the Austin court identified a new governmental interest in limiting political speech, an anti-distortion interest. Austin found a compelling governmental interest in preventing the corrosive and distorting effects of immense aggregations of wealth that are accumulated with the help of the corporate form and that have little or no correlation to the public support for the corporation's political ideas. Section B. The court is thus confronted with conflicting lines of precedent. A pre-Austin line that forbids restrictions on political speech based on the speaker's corporate identity, and a post-Austin line that permits them. No case before Austin had held that Congress could prohibit independent expenditures for political speech based on the speaker's corporate identity. Before Austin, Congress had enacted legislation for this purpose, and the government urged the same proposition before this court. See MCFL and California Medical Association v. Federal Election Commission. In neither of these cases did the court adopt the proposition. PACs are burdensome alternatives. They are expensive to administer and subject to extensive regulations. For example, every PAC must appoint a treasurer, forward donations to the treasurer promptly, keep detailed records of the identities of the persons making donations, preserve receipts for 3 years, and file an organization statement and report changes to this information within 10 days. In its defense of the corporate speech restrictions in Section 441B, the government notes the anti-distortion rationale on which Austin and its progeny rest in part, yet it all but abandons reliance upon it. It argues instead that two other compelling interests support Austin's holding that corporate expenditure restrictions are constitutional, an anti-corruption interest, and a shareholder protection interest. We consider the 3 points in turn. 1. As for Austin's anti-distortion rationale, the government does little to defend it. And with good reason, for the rationale cannot support Section 441B. If the First Amendment has any force, it prohibits Congress from fining or jailing citizens or associations of citizens for simply engaging in political speech. If the anti-distortion rationale were to be accepted, however, it would permit government to ban political speech simply because the speaker is an association that has taken on the corporate form. The government contends that Austin permits it to ban corporate expenditures for almost all forms of communication stemming from a corporation. If Austin were correct, the government could prohibit a corporation from expressing political views in media beyond those presented here, such as by printing books, The government responds that the FEC has never applied this statute to a book, and if it did, there would be quite a good as applied challenge. This troubling assertion of brooding governmental power cannot be reconciled with the confidence and stability in civic discourse that the First Amendment must secure. Political speech is indispensable to decision-making in a democracy, and this is no less true because the speech comes from a corporation rather than an individual. This protection for speech is inconsistent with Austin's anti-distortion rationale. Austin sought to defend the anti-distortion rationale as a means to prevent corporations from obtaining an unfair advantage in the political marketplace by using resources amassed in the economic marketplace. But Buckley rejected the premise that the government has an interest in equalizing the relative ability of individuals and groups to influence the outcome of elections. Buckley was specific in stating that the skyrocketing cost of political campaigns could not sustain the governmental prohibition. The First Amendment's protections do not depend on the speaker's financial ability to engage in public discussion. And that is just the beginning. PACs must file detailed monthly reports with the FEC, which are due at different times depending on the type of election that is about to occur. The court reaffirmed these conclusions when it invalidated the BCRA provision that increased the cap on contributions to one candidate if the opponent made certain expenditures from personal funds. The rule that political speech cannot be limited based on a speaker's wealth is a necessary consequence of the premise that the First Amendment generally prohibits the suppression of political speech based on the speaker's identity. Either as support for its anti-distortion rationale or as a further argument, the Austin majority undertook to distinguish wealthy individuals from corporations on the ground that state law grants corporations special advantages, such as limited liability, perpetual life, and favorable treatment of the accumulation and distribution of assets. This does not suffice, however, to allow laws prohibiting speech. It is rudimentary that the state cannot exact as the price of those special advantages, the forfeiture of First Amendment rights. It is irrelevant for purposes of the First Amendment that corporate funds may have little or no correlation to the public's support for the corporation's political ideas. All speakers, including individuals and the media, use money amassed from the economic marketplace to fund their speech. The First Amendment protects the resulting speech, even if it was enabled by economic transactions with persons or entities who disagree with the speaker's ideas. Austin's anti-distortion rationale would produce the dangerous and unacceptable consequence that Congress could ban political speech of media corporations. Media corporations are now exempt from Section 441B's ban on corporate expenditures. Yet media corporations accumulate wealth with the help of the corporate form. The largest media corporations have immense aggregations of wealth, and the views expressed by media corporations often have little or no correlation to the public's support for those views. Thus, under the government's reasoning, wealthy media corporations could have their voices diminished to put them on par with other media entities. There is no precedent for permitting this under the First Amendment. The media exemption discloses further difficulties with the law now under consideration. There is no precedent supporting laws that attempt to distinguish between corporations which are deemed to be exempt as media corporations and those which are not. We have consistently rejected the proposition that the institutional press has any constitutional privilege beyond that of their speakers. With the advent of the internet and the decline of print and broadcast media, moreover, the line between the media and others who wish to comment on political and social issues becomes far more blurred. The law's exception for media corporations is, on its own terms, all but an admission of the invalidity of the anti-distortion rationale. These reports must contain information regarding the amount of cash on hand, the total amount of receipts, detailed by 10 different categories, the identification of each political committee and candidates authorized or affiliated committee making contributions, and any persons making loans, providing rebates, refunds, dividends, or interest, or any other offset to operating expenditures in an aggregate amount of over $200. And the exemption results in a further separate reason for finding this law invalid. Again, by its own terms, the law exempts some corporations but covers others. Even though both have the need or the motive to communicate their views, the exemption applies to media corporations owned or controlled by corporations that have diverse and substantial investments and participate in endeavors other than news. So, even assuming the most doubtful proposition that a news organization has a right to speak when others do not, the exemption would allow a conglomerate that owns both a media business and an unrelated business to influence or control the media in order to advance its overall business interest. At the same time, some other corporation with an identical business interest but no media outlet in its ownership structure would be forbidden to speak or inform the public about the same issue. This differential treatment cannot be squared with the First Amendment. There is simply no support for the view that the First Amendment, as originally understood, would permit the suppression of political speech by media corporations. The framers may not have anticipated modern business and media corporations. Yet, television networks and major newspapers owned by media corporations have become the most important means of mass communication in modern times. The First Amendment was certainly not understood to condone the suppression of political speech in society's most salient media. It was understood as a response to the repression of speech and the press that had existed in England and the heavy taxes on the press that were imposed in the colonies. The great debates between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists over our founding document were published and expressed in the most important means of mass communication of that era, newspapers owned by individuals. At the founding, speech was open, comprehensive and vital to society's definition of itself. There were no limits on the sources of speech and knowledge. The framers may have been unaware of certain types of speakers or forms of communication, but that does not mean that those speakers and media are entitled to less First Amendment protection than those types of speakers and media that provided the means of communicating political ideas when the Bill of Rights was adopted. Austin interferes with the open marketplace of ideas protected by the First Amendment. It permits the government to ban the political speech of millions of associations of citizens. Most of these are small corporations without large amounts of wealth. This fact belies the government's argument that the statute is justified on the ground that it prevents the distorting effects of immense aggregations of wealth. It is not even aimed at amassed wealth. The censorship we now confront is vast in its reach. The government has muffled the voices that best represent the most significant segments of the economy. The total amount of all disbursements, detailed by 12 different categories, the names of all authorized or affiliated committees to whom expenditures aggregating over $200 have been made, persons to whom loan repayments or refunds have been made, the total sum of all contributions, operating expenses, outstanding debts and obligations, and the settlement terms of the retirement of any debt or obligation. And the electorate has been deprived of information, knowledge, and opinion vital to its function. By suppressing the speech of manifold corporations, both for-profit and nonprofit, the government prevents their voices and viewpoints from reaching the public and advising voters on which persons or entities are hostile to their interests. Factions will necessarily form in our republic, but the remedy of destroying the liberty of some factions is worse than the disease. Factions should be checked by permitting them all to speak, and by entrusting the people to judge what is true and what is false. The purpose and effect of this law is to prevent corporations, including small and nonprofit corporations, from presenting both facts and opinions to the public. This makes Austin's anti-distortion rationale all the more an aberration. Corporate executives and employees, counsel members of Congress and presidential administrations on many issues, as a matter of routine and often in private. An Amici brief filed on behalf of Montana and 25 other states notes that lobbying and corporate communications with elected officials occur on a regular basis. When that phenomenon is coupled with Section 441B, the result is that smaller or nonprofit corporations cannot raise a voice to object when other corporations, including those with vast wealth, are cooperating with the government. That cooperation may sometimes be voluntary, or it may be at the demand of a government official who uses his or her authority, influence, and power to threaten corporations to support the government's policies. Those kinds of interactions are often unknown and unseen. The speech that Section 441B forbids, though, is public, and all can judge its content and purpose. References to massive corporate treasuries should not mask the real operation of this law. Rhetoric, ought not obscure reality. Even if Section 441B's expenditure ban were constitutional, wealthy corporations could still lobby elected officials, although smaller corporations may not have the resources to do so. And wealthy individuals and unincorporated associations can spend unlimited amounts on independent expenditures. Yet certain disfavored associations of citizens, those that have taken on the corporate form, are penalized for engaging in the same political speech. When government seeks to use its full power, including the criminal law, to command where a person may get his or her information, or what distrusted source he or she may not hear, it uses censorship to control thought. This is unlawful. The First Amendment confirms the freedom to think for ourselves. 2. What we have said also shows the invalidity of other arguments made by the government, for the most part relinquishing the anti-distortion rationale. The government falls back on the argument that corporate political speech can be banned in order to prevent corruption or its appearance. In Buckley, the court found this interest sufficiently important to allow limits on contributions, but did not extend that reasoning to expenditure limits. When Buckley examined an expenditure ban, it found that the governmental interests in preventing corruption and the appearance of corruption was inadequate to justify the ban on independent expenditures. With regard to large direct contributions, Buckley reasoned that they could be given to secure a political quid pro quo, and that the scope of such pernicious practices can never be reliably ascertained. The practices, Buckley noted, would be covered by bribery laws. If a quid pro quo arrangement were proved. The court, in consequence, has noted that restrictions on direct contributions are preventative because few, if any, contributions to candidates will involve quid pro quo arrangements. The Buckley court, nevertheless, sustained limits on direct contributions in order to ensure against the reality or appearance of corruption. That case did not extend this rationale to independent expenditures, and the court does not do so here. The absence or pre-arrangement and coordination of an expenditure with the candidate or his agent not only undermines the value of the expenditure to the candidate, but also alleviates the danger that expenditures will be given as a quid pro quo for improper commitments from the candidate. Limits on independent expenditures, such as Section 441B, have a chilling effect extending well beyond the government's interest in preventing quid pro quo corruption. The anti-corruption interest is not sufficient to displace the speech here in question. States do not restrict independent expenditures by for-profit corporations. The government does not claim that these expenditures have corrupted the political process in those states. A single footnote in Bilotti purported to leave open the possibility that corporate independent expenditures could be shown to cause corruption. For the reasons explained above, we now conclude that independent expenditures, including those made by corporations, do not give rise to corruption or the appearance of corruption. Dicta in Bilotti's footnote suggests that a corporation's right to speak on issues of general public interest implies no comparable right in the quite different context of participation in a political campaign for election to public office. Citing the portion of Buckley that invalidated the federal independent expenditure ban and a law review student comment, Bilotti surmised that Congress might well be able to demonstrate the existence of a danger of real or apparent corruption in independent expenditures by corporations to influence candidate elections. Buckley, however, struck down a ban on independent expenditures to support candidates that covered corporations, and explained that the distinction between discussion of issues and candidates and advocacy of election or defeat of candidates may often dissolve in practical application. Bilotti's dictum is thus supported by a law review student comment, which misinterpreted Buckley. Seizing on this aside in Bilotti's footnote, the court in NRWC did say there is a sufficient governmental interest in ensuring that substantial aggregations of wealth amassed by corporations would not be used to incur political debts from legislators who are aided by the contributions. NRWC, however, has little relevance here. NRWC decided no more than that a restriction on a corporation's ability to solicit funds for its segregated PAC, which made direct contributions to candidates, did not violate the First Amendment. NRWC thus involved contribution limits, which, unlike limits on independent expenditures, have been an accepted means to prevent quid pro quo corruption. Citizens United has not made direct contributions to candidates, and it has not suggested that the court should reconsider whether contribution limits should be subjected to rigorous First Amendment scrutiny. When Buckley identified a sufficiently important governmental interest in preventing corruption or the appearance of corruption, that interest was limited to quid pro quo corruption. The fact that speakers may have influence over or access to elected officials does not mean that these officials are corrupt. Favoritism and influence are not avoidable in representative politics. It is in the nature of an elected representative to favor certain policies and, by necessary corollary, to favor the voters and contributors who support those policies. It is well understood that a substantial and legitimate reason, if not the only reason, to cast a vote for or to make a contribution to one candidate over another is that the candidate will respond by producing those political outcomes the supporter favors. Democracy is premised on responsiveness. Reliance on a generic favoritism or influence theory is at odds with standard First Amendment analyses because it is unbounded and susceptible to no limiting principle. The appearance of influence or access, furthermore, will not cause the electorate to lose faith in our democracy. By definition, an independent expenditure is a political speech presented to the electorate that is not coordinated with the candidate. The fact that a corporation or any other speaker is willing to spend money to try to persuade voters presupposes that the people have the ultimate influence over elected officials. This is inconsistent with any suggestion that the electorate will refuse to take part in democratic governance because of additional political speech made by a corporation or any other speaker. Caperton v. A.T. Massey Coal Company, 2009, is not to the contrary. Caperton held that a judge was required to recuse himself when a person with a personal stake in a particular case had a significant and disproportionate influence in placing the judge on the case by raising funds or directing the judge's election campaign when the case was pending or imminent. The remedy of recusal was based on a litigant's due process right to a fair trial before an unbiased judge. Caperton's holding was limited to the rule that the judge must be recused, not that the litigant's political speech could be banned. The McConnell record was over 100,000 pages long, yet it does not have any direct examples of votes being exchanged for expenditures. This confirms Buckley's reasoning that independent expenditures do not lead to or create the appearance of quid pro quo corruption. In fact, there is only scant evidence that independent expenditures even ingratiate. Ingratiation and access, in any event, are not corruption. The BICRA record establishes that certain donations to political parties called soft money were made to gain access to elected officials. This case, however, is about independent expenditures, not soft money. When Congress finds that a problem exists, we must give that finding due deference, but Congress may not choose an unconstitutional remedy. If elected officials succumb to improper influences from independent expenditures, if they surrender their best judgment, and if they put expediency before principle, then surely there is cause for concern. We must give weight to attempts by Congress to seek to dispel either the appearance or the reality of these influences. The remedies enacted by law, however, must comply with the First Amendment, and it is our law and our tradition that more speech, not less, is the governing rule. An outright ban on corporate political speech during the critical pre-election period is not a permissible remedy. Here, Congress has created categorical bans on speech that are asymmetrical to preventing quid pro quo corruption. 3. The government contends further that corporate independent expenditures can be limited because of its interest in protecting dissenting shareholders from being compelled to fund corporate political speech. This asserted interest, like Austin's anti-distortion rationale, would allow the government to ban the political speech even of media corporations. Assume, for example, that a shareholder of a corporation that owns a newspaper disagrees with the political views the newspaper expresses. Under the government's view, that potential disagreement could give the government the authority to restrict the media corporation's political speech. The First Amendment does not allow that power. There is, furthermore, little evidence of abuse that cannot be corrected by shareholders through the procedures of corporate democracy. Those reasons are sufficient to reject this shareholder protection interest, and moreover, the statute is both under-inclusive and over-inclusive. As to the first, if Congress had been seeking to protect dissenting shareholders, it would not have banned corporate speech in only certain media within 30 or 60 days before an election. A dissenting shareholder's interests would be implicated by speech in any media at any time. As to the second, the statute is over-inclusive because it covers all corporations, including nonprofit corporations and for-profit corporations with only single shareholders. As to other corporations, the remedy is not to restrict speech, but to consider and explore other regulatory mechanisms. The regulatory mechanism here, based on speech, contravenes the First Amendment. 4. We need not reach the question whether the government has a compelling interest in preventing foreign individuals or associations from influencing our nation's political process. Section 441B is not limited to corporations or associations that were created in foreign countries or funded predominantly by foreign shareholders. Section 441B, therefore, would be overbroad, even if we assumed, arguendo, that the government has a compelling interest in limiting foreign influence over our political process. Section C. Our precedent is to be respected unless the most convincing of reasons demonstrates that adherence to it puts us on a course that is sure error. Beyond workability, the relevant factors in deciding whether to adhere to the principle of stare decisis include the antiquity of the precedent, the reliance interests at stake, and, of course, whether the decision was well-reasoned. We have also examined whether experience has pointed up the precedent's shortcomings. These considerations counsel in favor of rejecting Austin, which itself contravened this court's earlier precedents in Buckley and Bellotti. This court has not hesitated to overrule decisions offensive to the First Amendment. Stare decisis is a principle of policy and not a mechanical formula of adherence to the latest decision. For the reasons above, it must be concluded that Austin was not well reasoned. The government defends Austin, relying almost entirely on the quid pro quo interest, the corruption interest, or the shareholder interest, and not Austin's expressed anti-distortion rationale. When neither party defends the reasoning of a precedent, the principle of adhering to that precedent through stare decisis is diminished. Austin abandoned First Amendment principles. Furthermore, by relying on language in some of our precedents that traces back to the automobile workers' court's flawed historical account of campaign finance laws. Austin is undermined by experience since its announcement. Political speech is so ingrained in our culture that speakers find ways to circumvent campaign finance laws. Our nation's speech dynamic is changing, and informative voices should not have to circumvent onerous restrictions to exercise their First Amendment rights. Speakers have become adept at presenting citizens with sound bites, talking points, and scripted messages that dominate the 24-hour news cycle. Corporations, like individuals, do not have monolithic views. On certain topics, corporations may possess valuable expertise, leaving them the best equipped to point out errors or fallacies in speech of all sorts, including the speech of candidates and elected officials. Rapid changes in technology and the creative dynamic inherent in the concept of free expression counsel against upholding a law that restricts political speech in certain media or by certain speakers. Today, 30-second television ads may be the most effective way to convey a political message. Soon, however, it may be that internet sources such as blogs and social networking websites will provide citizens with significant information about political candidates and issues. Yet Section 441B would seem to ban a blog post expressly advocating the election or defeat of a candidate if that blog were created with corporate funds. The First Amendment does not permit Congress to make these categorical distinctions based on the corporate identity of the speaker and the content of the political speech. No serious reliance interests are at stake. As the court stated in Payne v. Tennessee, 1991, reliance interests are important considerations in property and contract cases, where parties may have acted in conformance with existing legal rules in order to conduct transactions. Here, though, parties have been prevented from acting. Corporations have been banned from making independent expenditures. Legislatures may have enacted bans on corporate expenditures, believing that those bans were constitutional. This is not a compelling interest for stare decisis. If it were, legislative acts could prevent us from overruling our own precedents, thereby interfering with our duty to say what the law is. Due consideration leads to this conclusion. Austin should be, and now is, overruled. We return to the principle established in Buckley and Bilotti that the government may not suppress political speech on the basis of the speaker's corporate identity. No sufficient governmental interest justifies limits on the political speech of nonprofit or for-profit corporations. Section D. Austin is overruled, so it provides no basis for allowing the government to limit corporate independent expenditures. As the government appears to concede, overruling Austin effectively invalidates not only BCRA Section 203, but also 2 U.S.C. 441B's prohibition on the use of corporate treasury funds for express advocacy. Section 441B's restrictions on corporate independent expenditures are therefore invalid and cannot be applied to Hillary. Given our conclusion, we are further required to overrule the part of McConnell that upheld BCRA Section 203's extension of Section 441B's restrictions on corporate independent expenditures. The McConnell Court relied on the anti-distortion interest recognized in Austin to uphold a greater restriction on speech than the restriction upheld in Austin, and we have found this interest unconvincing and insufficient. This part of McConnell is now overruled. Part 4. Section A. Citizens United next challenges BCRA's disclaimer and disclosure provisions as applied to Hillary and the three advertisements for the movie. Under BCRA, Section 311, televised electioneering communications funded by anyone other than a candidate must include a disclaimer that blank is responsible for the content of this advertising. The required statement must be made in a clearly spoken manner and displayed on the screen in a clearly readable manner for at least 4 seconds. It must state that the communication is not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee. It must also display the name and address or website address of the person or group that funded the advertisement. Under BCRA Section 201, any person who spends more than $10,000 on electioneering communications within a calendar year must file a disclosure statement with the FEC. That statement must identify the person making the expenditure, the amount of the expenditure, the election to which the communication was directed, and the names of certain contributors. Disclaimer and disclosure requirements may burden the ability to speak, but they impose no ceiling on campaign-related activities and do not prevent anyone from speaking. The court has subjected these requirements to exacting scrutiny, which requires a substantial relation between the disclosure requirement and a sufficiently important governmental interest. In Buckley, the court explained that disclosure could be justified based on a governmental interest in providing the electorate with information about the sources of election-related spending. The McConnell Court applied this interest in rejecting facial challenges to BCRA Sections 201 and 311. There was evidence in the record that independent groups were running election-related advertisements while hiding behind dubious and misleading names. The court, therefore, upheld BCRA Sections 201 and 311 on the ground that they would help citizens make informed choices in the political marketplace. Although both provisions were facially upheld, the court acknowledged that as-applied challenges would be available if a group could show a reasonable probability that disclosure of its contributors' names will subject them to threats, harassment, or reprisals from either government officials or private parties. For the reasons stated below, we find the statute valid as applied to the ads for the movie and to the movie itself. Section B. Citizens United sought to broadcast 1 30-second and 2 10-second ads to promote Hillary. Under FEC regulations, a communication that proposes a commercial transaction was not subject to 2 U.S.C. Section 441B's restrictions on corporate or union funding of electioneering communications. The regulations, however, do not exempt those communications from the disclaimer and disclosure requirements in BCRA Sections 201 and 311. Citizens United argues that the disclaimer requirements in Section 311 are unconstitutional as applied to its ads. It contends that the governmental interest in providing information to the electorate does not justify requiring disclaimers for any commercial advertisements, including the ones at issue here. We disagree. The ads fall within BCRA's definition of an electioneering communication. They referred to then-Senator Clinton by name shortly before a primary and contained pejorative references to her candidacy. The disclaimers required by Section 311 provide the electorate with information and ensure that the voters are fully informed about the person or group who is speaking. At the very least, the disclaimers avoid confusion by making clear that the ads are not funded by a candidate or political party. Citizens United argues that Section 311 is under-inclusive because it requires disclaimers for broadcast advertisements, but not for print or internet advertising. It asserts that Section 311 decreases both the quantity and effectiveness of the group's speech by forcing it to devote 4 seconds of each advertisement to the spoken disclaimer. We rejected these arguments in McConnell, and we now adhere to that decision as it pertains to the disclosure provisions. As a final point, Citizens United claims that, in any event, the disclosure requirements in Section 201 must be confined to speech that is the functional equivalent of express advocacy. The principal opinion in WRTL, limited to USC Section 441B's restrictions on independent expenditures to express advocacy and its functional equivalent. Citizens United seeks to import a similar distinction into BCRA's disclosure requirements. We reject this contention. The court has explained that disclosure is a less restrictive alternative to more comprehensive regulations of speech. In Buckley, the court upheld a disclosure requirement for independent expenditures, even though it invalidated a provision that imposed a ceiling on those expenditures. In McConnell, three justices who would have found Section 441B to be unconstitutional nonetheless voted to uphold BCRA's disclosure and disclaimer requirements. And the court has upheld registration and disclosure requirements on lobbyists, even though Congress has no power to ban lobbying itself. For these reasons, we reject Citizens United's contention that the disclosure requirements must be limited to speech that is the functional equivalent of express advocacy. Citizens United also disputes that an informational interest justifies the application of Section 201 to its ads, which only attempt to persuade viewers to see the film. Even if it disclosed the funding sources for the ads, Citizens United says, the information would not help viewers make informed choices in the political marketplace. This is similar to the argument rejected above with respect to disclaimers. Even if the ads only pertain to a commercial transaction, the public has an interest in knowing who is speaking about a candidate shortly before an election, because the informational interest alone is sufficient to justify application of Section 201 to these ads. It is not necessary to consider the government's other asserted interests. Last, Citizens United argues that disclosure requirements can chill donations to an organization by exposing donors to retaliation. Some amici point to recent events in which donors to certain causes were blacklisted, threatened, or otherwise targeted for retaliation. In McConnell, the court recognized that Section 201 would be unconstitutional as applied to an organization if there were a reasonable probability that the group's members would face threats, harassment, or reprisals if their names were disclosed. The examples cited by amici are cause for concern, Citizens United, however, has offered no evidence that its members may face similar threats or reprisals. To the contrary, Citizens United has been disclosing its donors for years and has identified no instance of harassment or retaliation. Shareholder objections raised through the procedures of corporate democracy can be more effective today because modern technology makes disclosures rapid and informative. A campaign finance system that pairs corporate independent expenditures with effective disclosure has not existed before today. It must be noted, furthermore, that many of Congress's findings in passing BCRA were premised on a system without adequate disclosure. With the advent of the internet, prompt disclosure of expenditures can provide shareholders and citizens with the information needed to hold corporations and elected officials accountable for their positions and supporters. Shareholders can determine whether their corporation's political speech advances the corporation's interest in making profits, and citizens can see whether elected officials are in the pocket of so-called moneyed interests. The First Amendment protects political speech, and disclosure permits citizens and shareholders to react to the speech of corporate entities in a proper way. This transparency enables the electorate to make informed decisions and give proper weight to different speakers and messages. Section C. For the same reasons we uphold the application of BCRA Sections 201 and 311 to the ads, we affirm their application to Hillary. We find no constitutional impediment to the application of BCRA's disclaimer and disclosure requirements to a movie broadcast via video on demand. And there has been no showing that, as applied in this case, these requirements would impose a chill on speech or expression. Part 5. When word concerning the plot of the movie Mr. Smith Goes to Washington reached the circles of government, some officials sought, by persuasion, to discourage its distribution. Under Austin, though, officials could have done more than discourage its distribution. They could have banned the film. After all, it, like Hillary, was speech funded by a corporation that was critical of members of Congress. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington may be fiction and caricature, but fiction and caricature can be a powerful force. Modern-day movies, television comedies, or skits on YouTube.com might portray public officials or public policies in unflattering ways. Yet, if a covered transmission during the blackout period creates the background for candidate endorsement or opposition, a felony occurs solely because a corporation, other than an exempt media corporation, has made the purchase, payment, distribution, loan, advance, deposit, or gift of money or anything of value in order to engage in political speech. Speech would be suppressed in the realm where its necessity is most evident, in the public dialogue preceding a real election. Governments are often hostile to speech, but under our law and our tradition, it seems stranger than fiction for our government to make this political speech a crime. Yet, this is the statute's purpose and design. Some members of the public might consider Hillary to be insightful and instructive. Some might find it to be neither high art nor a fair discussion on how to set the nation's course. Still others simply might suspend judgment on these points, but decide to think more about issues and candidates. Those choices and assessments, however, are not for the government to make. The First Amendment underwrites the freedom to experiment and to create in the realm of thought and speech. Citizens must be free to use new forms and new forums for the expression of ideas. The civic discourse belongs to the people, and the government may not prescribe the means used to conduct it. The judgment of the district court is reversed with respect to the constitutionality of 2 U.S.C. Section 441B's restrictions on corporate independent expenditures. The judgment is affirmed with respect to BCRA's disclaimer and disclosure requirements. The case is remanded for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. It is so ordered. We've come to the end of the opinion. Until next episode, thanks for listening to what SCOTUS wrote us.